Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Doing fantastic. Doing fantastic. Excited to be here. Big basketball weekend. I'm just really happy to be here with you, honorary spinster, Nikias Duncan. A lot of fun. And shout out to all the dunkers out there. Thank you for embracing your bounce once again. I'm excited, man. Actually, I'm kind of overwhelmed. Like, it was a lot.
There's a lot going on.
We had the whole end of the season, playoffs, and LeBron came back, Nets came back, WNBA came back, Hall of Fame, all that. I'm trying to exhale, man.
It's a lot of hoop in a short amount of time. As a hoops lover, I am here for it, but also it's a lot to follow at once. Quick Hall of Fame question for you. Are you relieved that Ben Wallace is finally in? Are you surprised that he's finally in?
Nah, Ben Wallace is the Hall of Fame. That defense and helping that team achieve those heights, yeah, I see it. Defensive pillar for a whole era, so salute to Ben Wallace.
It just kind of got to a point to where I didn't think he was going to make it. And, like, I've been kind of iffy on his case to begin with. The defense is...
Let me check his age when he was
in the league. Oh, come on, man. He's retired. That doesn't count. That doesn't count at all.
Let me just see.
No, because I'm just like, the defense is undeniable. I just didn't know how much the voters would weigh the offense in comparison to that. And, I mean, that would explain the weight, I feel like. But also, I mean, you can't push back. What is it, 4 Defensive Player of the Year awards? Just was probably the most impactful, at least one of the top 2 or 3 impactful interior defenders of the 2000s, without question. Was a champion, knocking off that 04 Lakers squad, which still remains quite... Would you classify that as an upset? Because I kind of would. Like, I don't want to be disrespectful to that Pistons team, but.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think it was going to happen at the time. So, yeah, I still classify that as a huge run that the Pistons made. I didn't see that one coming.
A pillar in the Eastern Conference for more than half the decade, and Ben Wallace was a big part of that. But congrats to him. Congrats to Chris Bosh finally getting in. Congrats to Chris Webber, also getting in. A good weekend for Chris's, it would appear. I don't understand why it took so long for Chris Webber, though. That I don't get. Like, he had the college stuff, as short-lived as that was, and he was just one of the best 4s in NBA history. Like, I don't get... He had the numbers. Like, he had some playoff success. What was the issue?
Somebody was mad.
Like, there had to be a lot of people mad if that's the case.
It only takes one, buddy.
I guess I don't keep up with the politics of it, but that's kind of absurd. It took him so long. I was kind of sad Chris Bosh didn't make it in last year, but I understood just how stacked this year's class was. I mean, you get Duncan, KG, and Kobe at the same time. It's fine to kind of push that a year or so. But congrats to Chris Bosh. Congrats to Chris Webber. Congrats to all of the Hall of Fame inductees. As you mentioned a little bit earlier, the WNBA did make its return on Friday. And boy, did we have some fun. We had a couple of game winners / go ahead. We had Sabrina Ionescu hitting the game winning 3. We had Diana Taurasi in the midst of a poor shooting game. She hits a game winning 3. And we get what was essentially like a 10 or 15 minute review after that game winning shot because the clock stopped after she, it was like kind of a scramble drill, got a turnover to get to Diana. She pulls up from like 28 and cashes it in. And then they had the review because after the turnover, the clock stopped. So they did not know how much time ran off. So it kind of ruined the moment, honestly.
Yeah. When you got to pull out a stopwatch, it kind of changes things.
Yeah. Like you can't do that. You can't do that. But going back to the Liberty really quickly, opened up the season with 2 games against the Indiana Fever. They are in the midst of a rebuild, I would say. A 2-0 start for the Liberty, though. I remember when we did our WNBA / NCAA pod with Monica McNutt, you had the Liberty as a bit of a sleeper team. How impressed were you with the squad over the weekend?
I was pleasantly surprised. I didn't know they would be able to score like that. I didn't know Laney was that much of a bucket. And, you know, Sabrina came back ready. So it's been exciting to see them be able to kind of move the ball, attack. And I think they're kind of on the way up. You know, the rookies playing well. I think they've got some pieces to make some moves. So that's kind of why I had them as a sleeper. When you have those two playing at that kind of level, they can make some waves. So I'm pleasantly surprised. I will not take a victory lap right now, but I did say they were a sleeper.
Not a victory lap, but just kind of chilling in the field right now. Just taking a leisurely stroll right now.
Just a reminder. Just say, hey, how we doing?
Just a reminder. Yeah, quick shout out to Benaji Laney, though. She has been incredible the first two games. Just using her in a multitude of ways, using her as a screener, letting her handle the ball a little bit. She's playing well off of Sabrina. They already have some, I guess not two man, some two-woman chemistry, I guess would be the correct way to phrase that. They hooked up on that game winner on Friday night. Some screening action, kind of get a pin in, run flows into some Chicago action to get a pull-up three for Sabrina. I ended up breaking down that play and also writing about that play for basketballnews.com just as a quick plug. But I've been pleasantly surprised. Like, they were, I mean, they were bad last year, but you can kind of see the skeleton of what they wanted to be. They were a team that wanted to play five out, spread it out, and just kind of bomb away. They didn't really have the personnel for it last year, especially with Sabrina only playing three games. She was going to be a driver of a lot of that offense. And also Asia Durr, who is still struggling with COVID. Just as a quick reminder that COVID is a very serious thing. She is reportedly going to miss this season as well. And her playing career is currently in question because of the health issues that she's had to deal with. So prayers up to her. Hopefully she's able to get back healthy, if not for basketball, just for a better quality of life. But you saw the sheets that Walt Hawkins was trying to establish last year just as a spread it out team, five out. And now you get Sabrina in there that can make any pass in the book, can get to the basket, can pull up whenever she wants to, just kind of forces defensive attention. You have a center like Kylie Shook, who isn't a major scoring threat but can spread it a little bit, sets physical screens, so that just kind of helps you unlock the guard play there. I see the vision. Now, I need to see them against a better team than the Fever. But you can at least see what they're building towards.
So you're saying this two-game win streak was a Stranger thing?
Wow. I can't even hate on that one. That's good.
Hey, I'm here.
That's good. We got WNBA puns. I'm very proud. Do I get to yell yet, or should I just talk about the Connecticut Sun starting out 2-0?
We can talk about the Sun. I'm surprised you haven't gotten to the Sky yet. I thought you were going to fly right in there with that, but I'm right there. I'm right here with you.
You know, we can go Sky. Like, I don't have anything major to add on that point, except Candace Parker has fit in like many expected her to. Just her defensive ability allows Chicago to do a multitude of things, can play drop, can play more aggressive and pick and roll if they need to. She had, I believe, three blocks in that game and made many more rotations that kind of stilted the action for Washington. And they were missing some pieces, but she was flying all over the place defensively. And whenever she was able to grab a defensive rebound, just put the points on the board. Just her ability to grab and go and play make or just go coast to coast in general just unlocks a new dynamic for Chicago in transition. Because normally, last year, if a big got a defensive rebound, it's a quick kick out to Courtney Vandersloot or to Allie Quigley, and they kind of run the action. Now you have Candace doing that, and you have a Kalia Cooper on the wings. You have a Diamond to Shield on the wings. You have either Allie Quigley or Courtney Vandersloot kind of filling the wings. There's only so much you can do as a defense. Like, it's incredibly hard to match up with that kind of talent in transition anyway. You add someone like Candace Parker who can make those passes or get to the rim. I don't know how you stop that. I just don't know how you stop that.
All right, you got to make some quick decisions. And she was great off the break, leading the break for him. I thought the Sky's defense was really impressive in that game against Washington. Obviously, the Mystics missing pieces, but they were active, disruptive, physical. I just like the way things are coming together. You know, with Parker and Vandersloot together, should be fun to watch. And there were a couple of possessions, you know, Parker sets a pin down for Quigley. Quigley cuts back door. Candace pops. It's an open three. you're able to force the defense to make those kind of decisions and kind of move those pieces around. So I was pleasantly surprised by their debut and what they look like as quickly as it kind of came about.
I'm trying to gauge it.
No pun
okay.
intended.
No okay. Pun. Okay. I was about to ask. I was like, surely you didn't slip another one in there. That's impressive. But yeah, if that's what Chicago's going to look like in transition, they're going to have all those playmakers in the half court. And I already like, to your point, I love the multitude of ways they use Candace. Like, they let her handle the ball, the break, work some handoffs. They'd run some slice action, get it down on the block. A lot of it. They opened the game with an empty corner pick and roll with her and Courtney Vandersloot. End up being a turnover, but Courtney Vandersloot with a tremendous slip pass against that switch. Just kind of went off the fingertips of Candace. But, like, if they can already make those quick hitters, yeah. Yeah, like, that's – like, this is the fear because they just have so much – they just have so much talent. I was about to say top-end talent, but they just have a lot of talent up and down the board. And adding a defensive player of the year, former MVP, future Hall of Famer to the mix, who can still make plays. And, just to add to that, she also had three ball going in that game. And she shot well from three last year. Like, if that's also going to be a consistent part of her game, I don't know where you send help because of the collective passing. And if you don't send help, like, everyone can score in some capacity. Pull-up shooting, movement shooting, driving, posting. Chicago Sky look kind of scale. I mean, it's a game, so we'll see how the rest of the season goes. But that was as scary a debut as you can ask for if you're looking at the Chicago Sky and projecting forward.
So they're going to take flight?
Not as good as the Stranger Thing one. I'll let you know. Just on the sun note, they also started 2-0 win against the Atlanta Dream on Friday, in which Jonquel Jones loudly reintroduced herself to the game. Missed a ton of time last season. Came back, did a little bit of everything. Post, shoot, they were running some plays for threes for her. Worked the mid-range game. Atlanta had no answer for her. They also had no answer for DeWanna Bonner, who just kind of filled in the gaps. Relocated around the perimeter, had some nice timely cuts, ran a couple pick and rolls. They just sliced Atlanta's interior up. And that kind of continued on Sunday when they played the Phoenix Mercury. A little bit less Jonquel Jones, more DeWanna Bonner. Again, just kind of dominating action, kind of filling the gaps wherever she needed to. How many front courts can deal with those two?
Not too many.
Because, like, this was something that I was – I think I tweeted about it on Friday. Well, I tweeted about it on Saturday. I was watching the game because I missed it live, watched it Saturday morning. And I was just like, how many teams have the size to deal with that, first and foremost? Like, the size and the skill combination there is just kind of tough. Like, I don't know – because it's weird because, like, I even posted a clip on my timeline with Jonquel Jones where she grabbed a defensive rebound, pushed it all the way – goes like with a Euro step, absorbs contact and finishes over top. And I'm just like, if that's your five, good freaking luck. Like, I don't know what you do with that. And then you have DeWanna Bonner, who can just kind of flow around the perimeter, slice you up if you cheat anywhere else, and then get to the free throw line whenever you want to. So you have a security blanket there as well. And then you have solid guard play to kind of play off of those two. So maybe it might just be a blind spot on my part. Like, maybe I just underestimated the kind of damage that the Sun could do coming into this year.
It seems like you were sleeping on them. And they've got some great point guard play. Shout out to Bree January for continuing to do what she does. But I like what they do. And I think that it'll be different. I think I'd like to see them play a couple more games, but they definitely have the pieces to, I think, make some noise.
Fair enough. Okay, now can I yell?
Yeah, go ahead and yell at Ben Laimbeer, man.
Okay, so I do want to yell at Bill Laimbeer, but I'm not going to yell at Bill Laimbeer. First and foremost, the Seattle Storm are really freaking good. Breonna Stewart is really freaking good. Ezzie's good. Jewel Lloyd is good. Sue Bird is still good somehow. I was a little bit worried towards the second half of that game where she suffered what looks like, I don't know if it was like a foot or an ankle or something, but she ended up staying in the game, kind of shook it off or whatever.
But Aang knees. Was that Sue Bird slander, by the way?
No, it's not Sue Bird slander. I was trying to remember the play.
You said somehow. still I mean, good somehow.
I mean, yeah, she's what, 40, 41? Like, that's not a diss. Like, it's impressive that she's still impactful at this age. That was not slander. You're not about to set me up with Sue Bird like that. Come on now.
That was slander. Continue on.
That's not... I'll be very clear. I am not slandering Sue Bird at all. It is legitimately impressive that she's still rolling. But anyway, the Storm are really good. Just an elite offensive team. And I'm a little disappointed in what I saw from the Aces defensively. Like, it's game one. They're still trying to work in pieces, most notably Liz Cambage, who opted out of last season. So trying to figure out how to get her touches, get Asia Wilson touches, get Jackie Young touches, get Chelsea Gray touches. She's, you know, she's in, new to the team this year. It was a lot to work through. That first quarter was very exciting. Our first 56 seconds of the game, Liz Cambage draws two fouls early on deep post touches. Asia had the mid-range game going. She hit a three from the right wing, which made me literally jump off my couch when I watched. I was like, huh, if...
How many threes did they hit the half, first half?
Okay. See, you're already about to rain on my parade. So Asia hits the three on the right wing. I jump off my couch. I tweet about it. And that was the only three that the Aces made in the first half. Because as fun as the, like, first seven-ish minutes of the first quarter were, the next 13 minutes and a half were not so fun as an Aces supporter, I must say. The Storm really got going, attacking the Aces switches. Made a mini breakdown video about that. The Aces were trying to scram switch, and it did not go well at all. Just quick slips, quick cuts, didn't take much. And once the Aces got in rotation, and that was just it. Ball movement, shooting. Again, the cuts were there as well. Like, the, at a certain point, the Storm got rolling, and then they just could not slow them down at all. So it was not a fun time for me in particular, but shout out to the Storm. Like, they are a freaking buzzsaw.
No, they're really good. And the Storm just keep coming at you in waves. I mean, when they start moving the ball, they start punishing your mistakes. Once you're in rotation, it's tough to get back. They find the opening, keep moving it, keep swinging it, and then they attack. But just that combination of talent they have, you know, the way that you can use Stewart as far as posting up, ISO, pick and roll, pick and pop, let her handle it, almost mismatch hunt, like they did against the Aces sometimes against those switches. You got Jewel Lloyd attacking off the bounce like she did the other day. You got Canada off the bench. I liked what Katie Lou Samuelson brought to the table on both ends of the floor as far as being able to defend, being able to be solid, move, hit a couple shots. And then Sue Bird just operating all that. So it's really hard to deal with that combination. And I think the question wasn't, will the Storm be good? It's when will it kind of click? Will they be able to put it together? And it looks pretty darn good to start. So I think the Aces will be fine. I mean, you just can't – some of the things they did, you just can't do. You know, if you're going to scram switch, you have to time it up well. You can't let the defense see that you're about to do it, and then they just find the open person. So it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, like there were some pretty I'm trying not to hang on this too long, but there were some pretty blatant examples of poor switching that made it even easier for the Storm to execute. And you just can't do that. You just can't do that. Like, the amount of times that I just saw a guard or a forward just kind of hanging in the middle of the paint, just expecting someone on the backside to rotate over, and nobody rotated over because they were trying to figure out what the heck was going on. If you have championship aspirations, and again, it's game one, not super overreacting, but just in terms of what we saw, like, that's not going to cut it. And this is the team that 3-0'd you last year in the finals. So I just expected a little bit better, especially after the hot start. But again, we'll see how it progresses going forward. I mean, especially when it comes to something like scram switching, like, that just takes reps and communication. The positive is that there was a lot of yelling, a lot of pointing. Like, they were doing the communicating part. It was just the execution part, which is obviously the most important part of it. But if you got that half, they get more reps and drill it. Bill Laimbeer is a fantastic defensive coach. They do have smart players, so I think they will get better. It was just an ugly showing on Saturday.
Wow, you gave Bill Laimbeer a compliment. This must be a new day. Also, Kayla McBride made a couple threes early in her Minnesota debut. What did you think of that?
I'm glad that she can knock down shots again. that's very cool. Very cool. Would have been nice to have last year, but that's all I got.
Moving right along. Side note, scoreboard watching. Looks like the Thunder did it.
Did the Thunder actually win? We are recording a little later than usual on a Sunday night, just to peel the curtain back a little bit. But the Thunder have won 117 to 112. How about it?
There you go. And hey, this is the dunker spot. You got to be on point. Mm-hmm. Nakaccurate Duncan.
Absolutely not. Absolutely the heck not. No, we're just going to Euro step right past that one. We are nearing the beginning of play-in time. The play-in is pretty much settled. We have Boston and Washington in the East. We have Indiana and Charlotte in the East. We have San Antonio and Memphis in the West. And it's looking like we're going to have Golden State and Los Angeles in the West. Where would you like to start?
Let's start in the Eastern Conference. Let's mix it up a little bit. I'm excited about this play-in. Right? You know, I think it's great. Obviously, you have more teams involved, more teams able to fight. But I think it's interesting. The teams that made it, they get that extra week to rest, recuperate, get some actual real playoff prep in. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say the top two seeds are at a disadvantage, which I can understand compared to everyone else. They also get the rest, but their playoff prep is kind of normal turnaround time. I mean, in a regular season ends on Wednesday. Right. You got Thursday and Friday, and then you're playing game one. So it's not too much different. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see how what kind of product we get once the real playoffs start. But let's talk about the play-in.
All right. You want to start in the East. Let's start with the 7-8. We have Boston and Washington. I will open with a very vague question. What is the most important matchup for you in that game?
The most important matchup is going to be who Boston uses Marcus Smart on. Do they put him on Beal? And who guards Russ? That's the one for me.
Who would you put Marcus Smart on?
I put him on Beal.
That was going to be my thinking. I say you put Smart on Beal. You just hope that he fights over it and get himself in foul trouble. Just bother Beal, because Beal is going to be your three-level scorer. Like, he's going to be the most dangerous guy you got to worry about. You're going to dip under screens against Rust. You're going to send your help at the rim when he gets there. Fly out, contest threes when they go up. If Rust beats you with the jumper, then you just kind of tip your cap and get ready to play whoever the winner of the 9-10 is. But I would not let Bradley Beal dictate terms. He can't go off, because if he goes off, you're sending extra attention to him, and that's allowing Russ to play like 4-on-3. And you can't do that either, just from that perspective. So I think you have to shift your attention to Beal on that point.
Well, here's the question. If that would put Kimbo on Westbrook, do you worry about the post-ups, the attacks at all?
I worry a little bit, but I worry a lot less than I would if Kimba was on Beal, or if they had Tatum on Beal and then they had Kimba elsewhere and then they just kind of go mismatch hunting from there and you have to send extra help anyway. So I think just having it kind of straightforward that way, having Kimba on Russ, you just kind of take your lumps. Again, you're going to dip under screens there and to shoot anyway. You're going to be able to rotate off, kind of close off the paint whenever you need to. And I think you just play it that way. There's only so much you can do with Kimba to begin with defensively. So I'm not going to further complicate things.
That makes sense. But Tatum is interesting because you could put him on one of those two and then you could stay home. Hopefully you can stay out of foul trouble. What do you think Boston can accomplish in their current state to get this done?
As far as moving out of the play-in or just in this particular game?
Winning this game, punching their ticket, going home and trying to figure things out.
I guess while we're on Kimba, Kimba's going to have to do he has a lot of responsibility on his plate now. I mean, with Jaylen Brown out, Jason Tatum's going to need somebody to take the pressure off of him. And as much as Marcus Smart won't mind being a number two, he can't be your number two in this game. Like, I don't think you want that. You want Kemba to give you some of that downhill juice. You want him to get going in pick and roll because you want to scramble this Washington defense, which has been a lot better over the last month and a half, but still from a personnel standpoint isn't great. There should be natural pockets for Kemba to attack. Like, this is a drop team with Robin Lopez or with Daniel Gafford. There will be pull-ups available for Kemba. If he's able to knock those down, those bigs will have to creep up. If they do creep up, he can get downhill, and he should be able to beat either of those bigs to the rim, Lopez more than Gafford. And if you have Washington defense scrambling, they have had, even during the good stretch, they've still had some pretty bad off-ball lapses that you can attack. So if Kemba's able to get both facets of his game going, that unlocks the passing. And if Boston's able to get you in rotation, then they should be in pretty good shape against this team. But they're going to need good Kemba, because Kemba's already going to be a little bit of a question mark defensively. Like I said, keep him on Russ, make him dip on, you know, duck under those screens and just kind of live with what happens, especially even with the pull-ups. But if he's already going to be kind of hunted on defense and he has one of those cold shooting nights on offense or can't get to the free throw line, that puts a lot of pressure on Jason Tatum. And Jason Tatum has been really freaking good this year, but no Brown, poor Kemba against that kind of scoring backcourt with Russ and Bill, that's a tough ask. So I think Kemba's the question for me. Like, he has to bring it.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing. Washington just keeps coming. I mean, salute to them for even getting to the 8 seed from where they were. I mean, to actually get outright. And I mean, even in the game against the Hornets, they're down early. And all of a sudden, they swing it, turn around, they're winning. Because they don't stop. I mean, even if it's Robin Lopez and Ish Smith leading the way, they just kind of keep fighting. They keep playing offense. Hopefully, they can get enough activity on the other end and beat you, which makes it tough in a single elimination format, quote unquote. Who do you think swings it more? Davis or Fournier?
Ooh. This is a good question.
I'm on a heater.
I respect it. I would probably say Fournier, because I think if you're just looking for a wing to kind of replace at least some of what Jaylen Brown brings, like, Fournier would be the option there. And he has been good since he's been back. Like, I don't remember the last time he's missed, honestly. Like, he has stepped up since Jaylen Brown's been down. So if he's able to get going, you know, flying off of screens, I'm kind of relocating around the perimeter, attacking that way. That could be a way to get Jason Tatum take some pressure off of there. I'm kind of wondering how Brad Stevens is going to play the rotation, like how long he's going to play Tatum. Because I wonder what that hybrid second unit is going to look like. If it's going to be, you know, Kemba and Fournier running things while Tatum gets a rest, like what those actions are going to look like, who's going to be prioritized at that point. But I think Fournier is the answer, because for Bertans, like, he can obviously light it up from three. But I do think just the way that Boston defends, I don't know if he's going to have a bunch of cracks to attack. Like, I do think they just kind of switch and stash smaller guys on him and kind of keep him in check. He can still shoot over the top. Like, he is that good of a shooter. But I think just from a schematic standpoint, I don't think he's going to bend your defense in a way that Fournier can if he gets rolling.
That makes sense. I mean, Boston's going to have to move the ball regardless of who the lineups are, especially with Jaylen Brown out. They don't have that movement. They've usually struggled. If they're not creating shots for each other, it's usually tougher for them. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that. It should be a fun one. I think that should be a fun match to see both sides kind of compete. It'll be interesting to see who comes out on top, because you could see Boston being able to pull this out. You could also see Washington on a run, going ahead, just taking this one.
Let's go right there, actually. Who do you have winning this Washington-Boston game?
I'll go Washington. I'll take Washington. I think they have momentum. I know some people doubt that, but I think they've got a belief, and I think they're going to go ahead and probably win a tight one just because of the two they have. Keep it close, mm-hmm. Win it in the fourth.
Ooh, okay. It's odd. I probably have a little bit more faith in Washington right now, just in a one-game type setup. I also just kind of find it hard to bet against Jason Tatum this year, though. Because he has been – I mean, he's just been great, period. But even in, like, these must wins or these national TV games, he has raised the bar consistently. And I do think ultimately, you know, Boston can, if Boston wants to, and I don't know if they're going to do this, but if Boston wants to, they can say, we're going to put Marcus Smart on Russ. We're going to put Jason Tatum on Bill or swap those two and cool. We'll live with what happens after that. Who is Washington even putting on Tatum?
Rui Hachimura.
Which Rui isn't as bad defensively as I thought he would be coming into the league. But like Rui is not a stopper by any means.
I mean, who else do you gonna put on him?
Yeah, that's kind of my thing. Like, especially with at least over, I mean, since the All-Star break, like Jason Tatum has been a lot better and more aggressive and more intentional about getting downhill and getting to the free throw line. You combine that with what he already brings as like a pull-up shooter, a sidestep shooter, a step-back shooter. If Rui gets in foul trouble, like, what do you do if you're Washington? I don't know what you do. And if Jason Tatum has a cooking, it's not going to matter anyway, just because of the release point, he can get a shot whenever he wants to. So there could be a situation where Rui might play him well and it still might not matter. I would say, I think Washington is definitely playing better right now. I think Boston wins this game because I don't think Tatum lets them lose. And that may be cliche, but I'm putting a lot of stock in what Jason Tatum's done this year.
I can see it. It should be a fun one.
Definitely going to be a fun one. I'm here for the St. Louis battle between Tatum and Beal.
We'll see if Beal's hamstring is right. He didn't look right in this one.
Yeah,
that's against the Hornets.
Like, I was surprised that he played. I guess I'm not surprised that he played, but I'm also surprised that he played. Like, this was obviously an important game. But also, you typically don't want to play around with hamstrings with a guy like Bradley Beal, who drives the way he does, who is important as he is, first and foremost. But the way he drives, just some of the angles that he takes and how much strain he puts on his legs. Like, Washington isn't Brooklyn. You can't just sit him until 100%. But, like, I would hope that he would have been closer to 90, 95% because he looked like he was in the 70s. Out there. So I wonder what that turnaround is going to look like for him. That's also a variable that could very well swing this game, because if Bill is not 100% or if he's out, like, I don't think he's going to be out, but if he's not 100%, that's put a lot of pressure on Russ. And like, Russ doesn't mind that, but we also have a pretty healthy dose of Russ games to where he tries to take things over and it doesn't go well. So that's very, as well as he's played lately, like, that's still very much on the table.
I can see it. But you know what else is on the table?
What else is on the table?
The Indiana Pacers.
I want to be excited for Pacers Hornets. And like, in a way I am, because I feel like it's going to be an up-tempo game. But
this seems like the play-in game tailor-made for you.
It is, if I knew what to expect from either of these teams outside of playing fast. But I don't know what to expect from either of these teams right now.
Tempo and points. Tempo. Go ahead and buckle up. I mean, for everything we said about Indiana, they've been scoring the heck out of the ball.
They have.
And Sabonis is back, and he's been playing really well. So
he has.
You got Sabonis. You got LeVert going. TJ McConnell always can flash a 15 assist game. I think he had 17 today. Brissett is just driving and scoring. So they're fun. And the Hornets, you know, they're going to get up and down.
This is true. And to that point, I still don't really know what either of these teams are doing on defense right now.
Well, neither do they.
Yeah. That's a good point. So a lot of points are going to be scored. The pace is going to be up. The pace is going to be up because the Pacers in it. But anyway, the pace is going to be up.
Ah, good shot. It's a good shot.
I'm sure we'll be saying that a lot during that game. I guess my question to kick things off is if the game does get close, I mean, the game does get tight towards the end, who is Charlotte running their offense through?
Oh, they'll run pick and roll. They got three guys they can initiate with, play out of it. So it'll be either LaMelo, Rozier, or Devontae, depending on how it's going. But run pick and roll, see what you got. Maybe one of them will get a pull-up going. Maybe the defense will help you get a kick out and play out of it.
It's just they do have the three guys. They just seem to really prioritize these pull-ups, and it's gotten into trouble in quite a few games, especially recently, when the well goes dry for Devontae Graham, when the well goes dry for LaMelo Ball, Ball, who isn't shooting as well as he was before he went out. That's putting a lot of strain on Terry Rozier. And as you mentioned, Indiana does have a lot of guys rolling right now. Like, at bare minimum, they could just dump the ball to Domantas Sabonis and he could just mash dudes. Like, I don't know who Charlotte's answer is for Sabonis right now.
It's Cody Zeller disrespect.
Is it Cody Zeller disrespect? Like, he's good. But, like, he's not Sabonis strong. He's not Sabonis good, and he's also not Sabonis strong.
That's Bismack Biyombo disrespect.
If Bismack Biyombo is closing games for you, then that might be a bit of an issue. Like, there's an easy hack there. And, like, if you're talking about running pick and rolls and getting things going, like, I feel like he's going to hinder the spacing a bit.
Well, what's the difference between Biyombo and Dwayne Dedmon?
You know what? I'm not taking this bait. Absolutely not. First and foremost, I think Dedmon's better than Bismack Biyombo.
What's the difference?
What do you mean, what's the difference? Well, one of them has hands. We can start there. That might make things a little bit different if you're talking about running pick and roll, if the guy can catch and also finish. What do you... That's not how that works. Absolutely not. Anyway, you're stepping over the Dwayne Dedmon shot. I think late game, it's going to come down to late game offense for Charlotte, because it is just a lot of pick and roll and pull-ups. And I wish they had a little bit more downhill juice. And I think that's really where they miss Hayward, as a guy that can kind of create in the mid-range and get downhill when he needed to. And they just don't have that guy right now. Like, LaMelo, throughout his rookie year, has made strides getting downhill, but he still isn't naturally that. So with Indiana being comfortable, I say comfortable, not necessarily good, because Lord knows they haven't been good, but being more comfortable switching, I think that is the game plan to kind of keep things in front for Charlotte, because they just don't have those natural drivers to bend your defense that way. I think it can get kind of tight down the stretch. Like, if you're asking me who has the edge, like, I would probably lean Indiana in this matchup, honestly.
Whose defense do you trust? You have Indiana, who loves to go over and be overactive. You have Charlotte, who can be active and disruptive, but also can miss rotations. So whose defense do you trust in a win-or-go-home situation?
Probably trust Indiana's a little bit more, which doesn't really feel good to say, because in a vacuum, I don't really trust their defense. But I think I do trust Indiana's more, if for no other reason than I do think they're going to have easier avenues to score on the other end in the half court, and they should be able to set up their half court defense. If they can kind of see what's coming at them, I think they'll have more of a prayer than Charlotte would, because I think even if Charlotte's tight on their rotations, Indiana has a guy like Sabonis that can just kind of break whatever they want to do anyway, just because what he brings as a post-up threat. So I probably lean Indy there on the defense discussion.
Okay. So you're taking the Pacers in this one?
I think I'm going to take the Pacers in this one. Hurts my heart a little bit, but I think I'm going to take the Pacers in this one.
I'm going to go with the Hornets. I feel like there's a zone somewhere they'll come up with. They're gonna throw everything out there. I don't know how it's gonna work, but I'm gonna go with the Hornets in this one.
All right, fair enough. Let's move out west. Kick things off with San Antonio and Memphis. You were yelling at me on the timeline about Memphis today. Do we want to dig into that?
Nope, I wasn't.
Okay, fair enough. We'll let it ride then. I am oddly excited for this matchup. And maybe that's just the nerd in me.
Actually, before you go, I'm going to re-ask a question.
Okay.
Does Memphis want to deal with Pop in a one-game series?
I'm a little bit worried about what Ja might see.
Whole lot of drop and it's switches.
Yeah, like just going back to the Warriors-Grizzlies game on Sunday. I've seen defenders go under on Ja. Doris Burke even made the comment that Golden State was kind of displaying a level of disrespect with how deep they were dropping against Ja. They gave him absolutely no respect beyond the three-point line. And it just kind of it was kind of startling to see just how much they didn't care about him shooting. And to Golden State's credit, he didn't capitalize. Like, it was a very odd game for Ja. He was still able to drive against those unders sometimes, getting to the paint, did draw some fouls, but ultimately it hurt the offense. The offense really struggled through three quarters. I think they had a 75 offensive rating through three quarters in the game. Like, not only could Ja not really gain consistent traction and force rotations, they also weren't knocking down shots from the perimeter, and they're not a great three-point shooting team anyway. So I would imagine Pop's last San Antonio is going to have the same blueprint. Like, hey, we're just going to dare Ja to beat us with jumpers. We're really going to dare him to beat us with jumpers. Like, we already have an interior defender in Jakob Poeltl that can roam the rim and swat shots. Not the strongest dude, but at least a guy that could probably bother Jonas Valanciunas on the block. And again, if you're just ignoring Ja the way that Golden State did, you can also just send help on those post-ups if you feel like you need them. They can just kind of muck up those actions. This could very well be a danger zone game for Memphis.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting part about Ja Morant. We talked about it as the season's progressed, because what Golden State did is not much different than what Milwaukee did to him earlier this season, is where they just said, hey, do whatever you want. Literally, I'm going to stay at the free throw line. If a screen comes, I'm going to go under. And you can figure it out. Now, Morant actually showed progress during that two-week stretch as far as, oh, you guys are going to do this. I'm going to take the pull-up, take a step back. He didn't necessarily have that confidence and juice in this situation. And that still kind of feels like the next step for him to take to kind of hit that next level. Because the tough part is, we can nitpick and talk about that, but he's still good at getting in the paint. He's still good at creating plays despite the defenses treating him like that. It's just going to be interesting to see in this situation, who's going to step up? You got a great starting lineup. Can you get your bench going? Mm-hmm. Can they handle the minutes changing? Which guys are you going to go to? Because at times they almost have too many options, you know, where you have Bain, you have Melton, you have Clark you can go to, you got Tillman you can go to. Who do you mix and match in that type of scenario? So it'll be interesting to see how Memphis handles that, especially having to fight to get to where they were, having this game. And now you got one shot and you're out. Again, you know, this isn't their first time in this scenario. So it'll be interesting to see. I think San Antonio, it's hard because they had so many games in such a span that I feel like we haven't really seen them in a long time. It's been the Spurs, but not all their pieces have been together. They're just trying to get through it. Like, hey, we're 10.
Right.
We'll see you guys later. So, I mean, but you have DeMar in that type of scenario, and I'm sure Dylan Brooks will guard him because they make Dylan Brooks guard everybody.
Yes.
And he actually did a heck of a job early against Steph Curry. But once that bottle pops, it's not much you can do about it.
Right.
But it'll be interesting to see. I think with San Antonio, they can go with those smaller lineups, and they could probably use their guards as screeners, try and create some mismatches for DeMar, and then maybe muck the game up on the other end, contain the paint, force those threes. And I want to see how Memphis responds, because we've seen them go up and down the ladder. We've seen the good, we've seen the bad, but this is where they're going to have to really kind of make it happen in a scenario against a team that's going to put pressure on them. Spurs defense hasn't been what it should be. If it was, they'd be higher up.
Right.
But they can score, and they should have at least some elements of game plan defense to make it tough.
Yeah, I mean, I made the I asked the late game question in regards to Indiana and Charlotte. For Memphis and San Antonio, like, that's gonna be tough. Again, like, what does Memphis do late in games? Because as good as Ja Morant is in a vacuum, he still has yet to figure it out consistently against those unders, or against switches for that matter. So the go-to guy, is it Valanciunas? Like, Dylan Brooks wants it to be Dylan Brooks. I don't know if it should be Dylan Brooks. Like,
it's got to be Ja. He's got to stir the drink. I mean, Memphis has had their fourth quarter adventures this year, but he has to stir the drink and open those plays up for those guys to make, or at least make a play, and then someone else can cook. Something like that. If it's just, I mean, Valanciunas has been great. Don't get me wrong, but please give him the ball. I'll take it.
I feel that. And on the other end, and this is also why the matchup intrigues me, because while DeMar DeRozan is very good, and I have my questions about Memphis' offense, I don't have any questions about Memphis' defense. Like, they do have the bodies to throw at DeMar. Most of, like, Dylan Brooks, as you mentioned, is a good on-ball defender. He has to stay out of foul trouble. That would be pretty important to him providing that kind of impact. But he can bother guys. He can get into the chest. Like, he's had battles with DeMar before. You can throw a guy like Kyle Anderson on DeMar DeRozan, if you want to. Kyle Anderson is also a very good defender, as throws a little bit more size, a little bit more strength, so you won't have DeMar bullying you to his spots. He'll at least make him work there. So I think this game ultimately is going to come down to late game execution, but this can really be won in transition. If either team has turnover issues, then we might not even get to a late game situation. Like, one of the most frustrating parts about watching that Warriors-Grizzlies game was just how sloppy both teams were with the ball. And when either of them had like a 4 or 5 minute stretch of containing the ball, they either extended the lead or cut into a deficit because they were able to operate from there. So I think if San Antonio has turnover issues, I think Memphis could be able to push the ball with Ja. They have a lot of smart players, know how to field, know how to cut. That shouldn't be much of an issue. And if Memphis turns the ball over, it's just not going to matter. Because if they turn the ball over, San Antonio is going to score, and Memphis already has issues scoring in the half court.
So who you got? You got Memphis?
I want to pick Memphis.
Do it. Pick them.
You know, I don't like there. You know what? I will pick Memphis.
I'll take the Spurs then.
That's fine. I'm sure one of us will be gloating when we do the midweek pod. But I do think Memphis is going to be able to get out and run a little bit. And I also trust Memphis's bench a little bit more than San Antonio's, which is odd to say when you have a guy like Patty Mills, who has like 18 years of experience at this point, and this can kind of win you a quarter on a whim. But I do like what Melton can bring. I do like what Brandon Clark can bring. I do like what Xavier Tillman can bring. I think this can be a game in which Memphis pushes the tempo, forces the hand a little bit. And I do think they have the defenders to bother DeMar. And if DeMar is off, like, he's really their best creator. Like, Jonte Murray isn't there yet. So I'll ride with the boat. I'll go down with the ship. I'll take Memphis.
Fun fact, they haven't played each other since February 1st. Do you know who the Grizzlies' leading scorer was in that game?
Leading scorer in a February 1st game. Was it Valanciunas?
It was your boy, Gorgui Dieng. Now a member of the Spurs.
Ah, interesting. How much joy did that stat bring you?
Like, minimal.
boo. All right, the real fun one. Golden State, LA. We got Steph, we got Bron, we got Anthony Davis, we got Frank Vogel, we got Steve Kerr, we have Lakers Twitter, we have Warriors Twitter. This is what the streets needed. This is also what the league needed.
Oh, I mean, if I'm a TV exec, I'm gleefully happy. We get to play in and we get to kick it off with Steph and LeBron. Please, thank you. So what do you see? Because this feels like just a fun quote unquote narrative experience more than anything else.
Yeah, I see a lot of good basketball players. That's a cop out. But no, like, I am interested to see how the Warriors match up with the Lakers. Like, I want to know how they dole out the matchups. Because whoever you don't put Draymond on should have some sort of inherent advantage. Like, if you're putting Draymond on Anthony Davis, then Andrew Wiggins has been good defensively this year. I worry about a LeBron matchup. And if you kind of toggle it and you put Draymond on LeBron, then is it Kevon Looney on Anthony Davis? Like, Kevon Looney is a good defender, but I don't know if I want him defending Anthony Davis in space. And then on the other side, the Lakers do have solid point of attack defenders. Like, they do have Dennis Schroeder. They do have Alex Caruso off the bench. They do have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who has plenty of experience chasing guys around screens. But also, none of those guys are like Steph stoppers. And it does not take much for Steph to erupt. So this is very much going to be a narrative game. But ultimately, I'm just curious to see how the chess pieces are going to be moved around defensively for either of those teams.
I think it'll be interesting. If the Warriors stay traditional, I'd imagine you got Looney on Drummond. They might start Draymond on Anthony Davis, maybe Bazemore on LeBron. I'm not sure. I wonder if they put old Toscano Anderson in the starting lineup. Maybe see if they can downsize the start. It'll be intriguing, but the intrigue is mainly Steph Curry losing his mind and the Lakers being in this situation. And Lakers look better. LeBron looks better this comeback than he did previously. He looks more like himself on both ends of the floor, which is the big plus for LA. It's what you wanted. Getting some more quality minutes out of those three together. And then those bench guys stepping up, playing better. Wesley Matthews actually looks like himself of late on both ends of the floor, which is a plus. And Caruso has been great defensively. But I'm interested to see, you know, they're going to make Drummond come up to the level. And he's been active, but it's going to be a lot. It's going to open some plays up. So how much do we see, you know, Draymond at the five, empty side, pick and roll, force the Lakers to rotate, that type of deal. The Lakers side, do we get to see Anthony Davis at the five? You know, who's going to be the guy? Because you probably get the minutes out of Drummond. I don't know where else they'll go from there. You know, I don't know if they'll throw Big Fella out there in this one, although they could and should. Mm-hmm. They haven't necessarily gone as small as many times. So it's a popcorn game for me. Everyone's going to lose their minds. I'm just going to enjoy the show.
Oh, absolutely. I guess to that point, yeah, Andre Drummond is going to be a pressure point in this game. Because I think he's going to dictate a lot of, A, how successful Golden State is. Because if he is able to get to the level and kind of disrupt things, then that combined with the point of attack defenders that the Lakers have, again, I don't think nobody's going to like stop Steph. But if you can bother him to that degree, and, you know, you're looking at actions that you bring a Drummond up to the level of the screen. Even if you slip that pass out early, you have Anthony Davis on the back line. You have LeBron James on the back line. So they, more than just about any tandem in the league, can cover like a 3-on-4 defensively and be fine if Steph's able to get the ball out early and try to play against that advantage. Like, those two can swallow up those opportunities easily. If Drummond isn't playable, then you kind of force Brow down to the five, which, that's quite the consolation prize. Like, oh no, Anthony Davis is playing his best position. Like, the more that I think about the matchup, like, I feel like, I mean, the Lakers are a better team. They should win this game. Like, I will pick them to win this game. But also, man, Steph can just break things open so easily.
That's the fun part. But my concern with the Warriors is, I mean, kind of the one I've had all season. What lineup can they throw out there where there's five threats? because I'm thinking in my head, as you talked about the weak side rotations, who do you have that's going to make LeBron not sit on the weak side and play free safety? And yeah, that's the problem. So if you have LeBron able to play free safety, then Drummond can, he's got a little bit more room for error because he's got the weak side helping him,
right?
Which means Golden State won't be able to make you pay quite as much. And then that opens things up for the Lakers to stick around, even if Steph gets hot, yada, 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 so on and so forth. So that's where I would want to see them hopefully be able to find that small lineup, so we can kind of at least see some pressure from the Lakers to have to rotate, continue to close out, make multiple efforts. But Lakers defense is kind of built for this type of game plan. But it's still Steph Curry, so sometimes it don't matter.
This is true. This is true. So, like I said, I'm probably going to take the Lakers in this game. Like, I just think the top-end talent is going to be a little bit too much. I think they have more ways to deal slash bother Steph than the inverse. Because even if Golden State downsizes, go Draymond at the five, to your point, they do have to make sure they have that lineup to where you have five threats out there. And also, if Draymond's at the five, the Lakers can just counter with Anthony Davis at the five. So it would take a Steph nuclear game. That's not completely off the table. But I just think the Lakers have a little bit too much for the Warriors to deal with.
It'd be a fun one. The fans are going to win this one.
The fans are absolutely going to win this. I'll put it like, I'll pose this question to you. If we record middle of the week and the Warriors have won this game against the Lakers, outside of Steph, who do you think has stepped up in that game to kind of force that hand?
Draymond Green.
Mm-hmm.
And Wiggins. I think it'd have to be Wiggins. He'd have to have a huge game. I mean, I could say like Jordan Poole or something like that, but I don't know.
I was expecting you to throw some Jordan Poole up in there.
Eh.
We're back to the eh. Okay. It's funny. Like, my answer is probably going to be Kent Bazemore, because I do think he's the guy that you can stash in the corner on the wing. Like, if he's going to, he would give you the random 14 off the bench. It's kind of my point.
I think the Lakers will live. That's no offense to Kent Bazemore, but I think they'll live with him beating them. And Jordan Poole's been great. That was for comedic effect.
Yeah, I got you. But yeah, that's kind of my point. Like, obviously, they're not game planning for Jordan Poole. Like, they're going to try to take away Steph. They're going to want to stop Draymond on the short roll. Like, Kent Bazemore is not forcing hard rotations, but because he is a guy that can snipe from the corners, he is someone that can kind of make the Lakers pay if they're going to pay, you know, send their attention elsewhere. So I think in a situation to where the Warriors get that win, then I can see him being a big part of it. That's all I'm saying.
No, I feel you. Also, public service announcement. If you see Looney or any sort of big man for the Golden State Warriors throwing a pass into the post, there's a screen for Steph Curry that's coming shortly thereafter. They've only been running post splits since 2015. I was still in the league when they started to do it. So just to let it appears some teams are not aware, just want to give this free service to you. The hashtag is also Big Mad.
I was just about to ask, is this a Big Mad for you? Like, I was cracking up reading your timeline as this was happening. Because, like, I saw one of your tweets about the post split action in which Memphis completely botched it defensively. You tweet it, I see it, I retweet it. Like, maybe two possessions later, Golden State runs another one. And I think Steph sets a screen for someone and then kind of reverse pivots and then flies off another Looney screen and then gets a three and cashes it in. Because the first one was a miss. But the second one, he cashes that one in. I'm just like, oh, man, Steve's going to lose his mind. And sure enough, you tweet that clip out with basically the same thing. Like,
I don't understand. It's a dead giveaway every time. Why do you think Looney's on the perimeter?
He's not taking pick and pop three.
No, you should have an alarm that goes off and says, uh-oh, where's Steph?
Yeah, like, Looney isn't picking and popping. If Kevon Looney is tossing an entry pass to Draymond Green, who is the other non-shooter on the floor, then surely they're not about to run a dribble handoff with Kevon Looney.
That bothered me.
Yeah, I see. I'm just going to guess, and this is only a guess, I'm going to guess that the Lakers are going to have a better handle on the action than the Grizzlies did.
They should. They should. But, I mean, they've been running it for so many years. I'm sure they'll catch them once or twice.
Yeah, I mean, I would like that to be a case of great execution, not, holy crap, where did Steph go? And that's what we saw with Memphis. Like, that can't happen. I think that wraps up the play-in. So let's just to wrap up, you have Washington. You have Washington. You have Charlotte. You also have the Lakers. And you have San Antonio. Do I have that right?
I have Washington, Charlotte, San Antonio, and the fans.
And that's such a cop-out. All right, that's fine. Well, then, I have Boston, I have Indiana, I have the Lakers, and I have the Grizzlies. So one of us is going to be happy midweek. We'll see. But we do have some series that are confirmed right now. Let's go back to the East. Let's talk Knicks-Hawks. Let's kick things off with your Knicks.
Oh, we're starting Knicks-Hawks. I'm surprised. I thought you were going to go on a huge Bucks rant.
No. We're going to save that. Let's go Knicks-Hawks first.
Well, I'll start with a question.
Okay.
Do the Atlanta Hawks have an answer for Julius Randle? February 15th, Randle had 44-9-5 against the Hawks. April 21st, Randle had 40-11-6 against the Hawks. What are your thoughts?
It's funny because like this was going to be my question to you. Like, this is my big question to coming into the series. Who defends Julius Randle? Because there isn't a great answer to that. Like, I just from watching the film, I just don't think John Collins can do it. I just don't think, like, he has made growth defensively, but his impact defensively is going to come on the weak side, kind of flying in for blocks and cleaning the glass and the possessions for you. It's not as an ISO defender. It's not really as a post defender. And you kind of need both of those elements to hang with Julius Randle. And as wiry strong as John Collins is, he didn't deal particularly well with the brute force that Julius Randle would drive with. He was really able to kind of lower the shoulder, get to the rim, or just hit him with a little shoulder chug and then go to his fadeaway. Would get him leaning and flowing to step backs. Just incredible shot making for Julius Randle during the regular season series. Like, a part of me wants to believe, like, all right, there has to be at least some regression because he was making some tough shots. But also, there's something to be said about Randle getting in that kind of rhythm. And John Collins was a part of Randle establishing that kind of rhythm. So I don't think Collins can do it. Like, I think their best bet is going to be some front court cross matching. I think Capella is going to be your better option on Randle. Just because I think it's equal or slightly more strength for Capella. But more than anything, he's just longer than Collins. And at the very least, if Randle wants to get into those pull-ups or those step-backs, Clint Capella can bother him a little bit more with his contest. And I think you deal with it that way. And again, John Collins is a good defensive rebounder. So I think him versus Nerlens Noel, that's a matchup that he can handle. Just kind of battle on the glass and then pushing in transition going the other way. But I think that's going to be Atlanta's best bet. Now, granted, the counter there, the Knicks were comfortable letting Randle run some 4-5 pick and roll. And what we saw in the regular season, like, Atlanta did switch that. So I kind of worry about how they deal with that. I mean, I guess you can at least try to make them work a little bit. It doesn't have to be a soft switch. But I think if you're just asking me what the matchups are going to be, like, I think you have to get Capella that matchup because I don't think Collins has the horses for it.
Very interesting. I too am worried about Collins as far as the strength goes. You know, does that open up the face up, the jab, the drives, the post moves for Julius Randle, the fadeaways, let him get in his bag there? My concern, I think they open with Collins, but my concern with Capella is a couple things. I'm not in love with him defending on the perimeter. Mm-hmm. So you worry about the face up off the bounce game that Randle has improved at, which is why he did it. It also kind of reminds me of when I was in Memphis, we played Oklahoma City, and it was Zebo against Serge Ibaka, and Zebo just went right at Ibaka. Like, it was fadeaways, left-hand drives, finish, just went right through him. They had to put Perk on him, which that's a whole other story. But I worry about that kind of deal happening. And then I worry about Randle and space. So if Capella's on Randall, and they will space Randall in pick and rolls, Capella's not always going to be the low man as far as defending. So you're not going to have that same drop presence. You're not going to have the same weak side rotations, which could open some other things up. So it'll be interesting. I'll throw a name at you that intrigued me. Okay. I don't know if he's the answer, but I think it's going to have to be kind of committee until you find something. Solomon Hill.
I am intrigued with him as kind of like an innings eater. Like, give us a random 6 minute, you know, give us a couple of 6 minute stretches against Randall, see if you can bother him a little bit. I don't know if I want a heavy dose of that though.
Well, what he does is he answers a little bit of the perimeter activity as far as being able to handle off the dribble. That's the problem true. Is I think Julius Randle thinks he can just shoot over him at any point in time, which opens that up. So how much is the activity worth? So I think you kind of have to give him multiple looks. You got to try and keep him out of rhythm. I think it'll be one of those three guys. They probably start with Collins, but it'll be interesting to see how they handle that. How much do you think they double him?
I think they're going to double him a good bit. At the very least, I think they're going to show like some aggressive nail help. Maybe it's just a stunt and then it'll recover out. Maybe not a hard double. Because Randall, at last check, I'll have to look at PBP stats. But at last check, I think he was leading the NBA in corner three assists per game. Like, not too long ago. That's probably, I checked that like 2 or 3 weeks ago, so it's probably changed by now. But the fact that he's up there just kind of highlights where he's getting this assist, and that speaks to where he's getting touches and where he's getting doubled. You get him on the block, he's just making that weak side skip every time. He's very good at making jump passes. Difficult thing to do, but he's good at it. So I don't think the Hawks want to give him too many built-in reads. Like, I understand trying to force the ball out of his hands. I think it's going to be more, let me just show a body and then get out of the way just to make him think about some things. And if we can get Randall late in the clock, then the efficiency drops a little bit and we can end some possessions that we get going on the other end of the floor. Like, I don't think it should be an automatic, because Randall is too good of a passer and he's also too smart of a player, especially at this point, to just send him automatic looks, because I think the Knicks are good at that weak side spacing, making themselves available. They'll mix in some random cuts from the slots and everything. So go ahead.
Did you just say the Knicks are good at spacing and the cuts are important? We are making progress.
All here. Right. Uh-oh. Here we go. I don't think they're the 14. I don't think they're the 14 Spurs like you do, but you know, they do what they can with the personnel that they have. That's all I'm saying.
That's a slanderous shot you got up. It's all right though. Just want you to know that. Here's another question I have for you. How many guys do the Knicks have that can pull Clint Capella up out of a drop?
I think the answer is like 1.5.
Who's the 1.5?
Like, up to the level in pick and roll, correct?
Yes.
Because I think Quickly is their best pull-up shooter. So I think Quickly can. And I'm curious to see how much they lean on Alec Burks off the bench. I think he would be the other guy. Because, like, while, you know, RJ Barrett can make plays in pick and roll, is going to be as a driver. Derrick Rose can make plays in pick and roll, is going to be as a driver. So Capella's going to drop there. I think Burks / Quickly are going to be the two guys that can really bury you from deep if they get going. And, like, Reggie Bullock isn't initiating pick and rolls like that. So I don't really worry about Capella in that stage either.
Okay. I'm going to lob you up one. How important is Trae Young in this playoff series?
Very important, and I will tell you why. I think Trae Young is very good. Like, I think he is worthy of an all-NBA team selection. I think he's been that good. He's been that important to Atlanta, the driver of what they've done. He was not good against the Knicks during the regular season series. I think Elfrid Payton did a good job of getting his jersey. I think New York's bigs were pretty active and not giving him easy reads getting downhill. So it was a lot of, you know, stopping on a dime, trying to get foul calls that way or leaning into that floater. Last year, Trae Young had the most effective floater in the league. This year, it has been very uneven. And if Trae Young doesn't have the floater going, then it's a bit of a problem. because the 3-point percentage, the raw percentage is always going to be a little bit underwhelming just because of the type of threes that he takes and from how far out he takes them. So it's hard to bank on that as an efficient source of offense per se. So he needs the downhill stuff, which is why the free throw rate is so important for him. And why, with him being a small guard, the floater is so important for him, because asking him to get all the way to the rim, you know, he has the ball handling ability and the burst to do so, but finishing over that kind of size consistently is a bit of an issue for him. So when you have Nerlens Noel at the rim, you need a counter. And that counter is the floater. But New York, during the regular season series, they were able to stay attached to his hip. And then when you have a guy like Nerlens Noel that can kind of chew up a little bit of space with his arms and backpedal, so you can't get all the way to the rim, and you also don't have a comfortable floater, it put a lot of stress on Trey. So Trey is going to have to figure out a way to find that middle ground. He's going to have to really dig into the bag of trips to get himself free on the initial pick. And if he's able to get the pull-up three going, some closer pull-up threes going, that can make the big creep up a little bit more. And all he needs is a step, because he was still able to fit in lobs to Clint Capella whenever he was able to draw the big up. He was able to do the same with John Collins. Back to the Collins point, with Atlanta running double drag as much as they do, one thing I did notice, New York wasn't switching that first screen a ton. So there were, I would normally expect like a peel switch or something with, especially with Collins, just take away that above the break three. But like, they left that open. They pretty much dared Collins to shoot. They wanted to make sure that Trey couldn't get downhill and that the lob wasn't there. So I think even with something like that, Trey's going to have an automatic as in a passing read there to hit Collins on that. And again, if he can figure out how to get some cleaner looks as a driver, like, I think he'll have some easier floater looks. And if the floater gets going, I think that's going to open up everything else.
Well, I think the decision-making, we've talked about it from Trae Young all year long. We've talked about the progress he's made, but with how the Knicks defend, they're comfortable being in a drop. Even if Noel starts closer to the level, he's dropping back, and the help may come from the strong side or the nail, depending on where the screen is set. So it's going to be up to Trae Young to make the right reads. He's got to make the right decisions with the volume of pick and rolls that he gets. You know, you talked about the floater. Will he take the mid-range? Will he take the pull-up three? Get the late penetration, get the late lob? Because as we've seen during the stretch, when he leads the dance, he's dangerous, because technically he can open everything up. He has all the tools in his bag, but he's going to have a lot of focus on those drives. He's not going to have a ton of space. So it'll be interesting to see how they loosen things up, if they can get the Knicks out of that comfort zone of, hey, we're just going to do what we do. We're going to show the help. Body's going to be here. You got to make the right choice all the time. And I think that ball movement is going to be key. You know, he's got to make the right pass when it's there. And Atlanta's going to have to attack those closeouts, keep the Knicks in rotation, find the open man. They have the lineups do so, especially with Bogdanovich playing well. You have Lou Williams off the bench playing well. Gallinari every now and then can heat up. So they have the people that can do it. It's just going to be, can they do it consistently? Because the Knicks are going to help. You know that. Mm-hmm. And if I'm the Knicks, I'm saying, hey, I have my defense set. I know what you're going to try and do. You guys have to beat us. And that'll be probably the back of the series. But I like how you mentioned the double drag, because the Hawks been running that a ton for Trae Young. Just two guys, let him get downhill, let him get some space and pick those defenses apart. I'm interested to see if Atlanta mixes in more slips with that second screen, try and give Capella a head start. And I'm interested to see if they kind of get some, you know, some empty side pick and roll with how the Knicks defend, try and see if they can open some things up, manipulate the defense a little bit. So it'll be fun.
And just to that double drag, look, it's not always with Collins and Capella. Like, they will mix in. They'll have Bogey as the first screener sometimes. They don't mind mixing in their guards there, too, just to kind of force a switch. Or if you're not going to switch, that just adds a little bit more confusion. So that's going to be interesting to watch. Like, I will say, just off rip, I don't anticipate Trey shooting as poorly as he did during the regular season series. Like, even just going through the possessions that he had against the Knicks, don't want to take away anything from the defense, because again, they did pressure him well going over screens. They did stay on his hip. The bigs did do a good job. And Trey still ended up missing a lot of shots that are in his wheelhouse. And any sort of positive regression for Trey on the looks that he did miss could spell some trouble for the New York Knicks. I mean, he is that kind of game-breaking talent offensively. Just what is he bring? Just what he brings as a pull-up shooter, getting to the line, what he brings as a passer. As you mentioned, the Knicks are going to help. Like, their defensive scheme is their defensive scheme. So you know where you're going to get your looks if you can get to them. And Trey has the ability to get to those looks. So I I would still lean Hawks in this series. I don't know if that's, I mean, I would hope that doesn't classify as a hot take, but I would lean Hawks in this series.
I already made my tweet, so.
Yep.
Knicks have to win. So who's your X factor for the Knicks, for the Hawks?
X factor for me overall is John Collins for the reasons I mentioned earlier. I do have a Knicks question for you. How much Elfrid Payton do you expect to see in this series?
About the same 15 minutes a game, probably 10, 15. Because they're gonna want his defense against Trae Young. So I don't imagine that he'll just be out, but I don't think he'll get a very long run. First quarter, third quarter.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, who would your X factor be in this series?
I still got Derrick Rose. I think this is a series where his shot making, his shot creation, him being a threat could help the Knicks. They're going to need him and or Burks and or Quickley to be able to change the pace and score those baskets and make those plays. And then for Atlanta, it's got to be Bogdanović. He's got to continue to play at this high level and make those shots. If he's playing that way, that takes less pressure off Collins and less pressure off Trae Young, and now you can kind of open some more things up. So I'm going with Bogdan Bogdipovich.
Okay. Well, let's move. Actually, you know, from there, we'll move to his former team that actually isn't his former team, the Milwaukee Bucks, who are slated to take on the Miami Heat in a highly anticipated 3-6 series.
I cannot wait to hear what you're going to say. You are backed into a corner, sir.
Am I backed into a corner?
Low-key.
Like, I feel like I'm...
Your Eastern Conference champion is facing your Eastern Conference dark horse. You can only have one be correct, sir.
That's true. But with that being said, I'm going to be correct in some facet in some place. So, I mean, I am fine. If the Bucks win, then... Bucks winning the East take is alive. And if not, then Miami is advancing. And I have no bones about that.
So you're a hedge better. I see you. Okay.
I'm not a hedge better. Like I think Miami is not in their most favorable bracket. I would not want to face Milwaukee in the first round if I were them. I'm sure the team doesn't care. They're ready to face whoever they want to face. But I think from like a fan perspective, it would have been nice if Miami were to win some of the gimmies that they dropped during the regular season so they could get into that 4-5 bracket. Because I do think if they were able to face one of Atlanta or New York in the 4-5 and then potentially face a Philadelphia in the second round, like I think they have a pretty clean Eastern Conference Finals pathway there. But now they have Milwaukee in the first round. And this is not the same Bucks team that they mollywopped in the second round last year. Giannis is better. Chris Middleton is very good. Jrue Holiday is much better than Eric Bledsoe and is also very good.
Wow, you just took Eric Bledsoe out. He's just in Cancun. You just took him out.
I mean, so does Stan, but I think it's going to be a fun matchup because I do think Miami still has some pathways to attack Milwaukee. Just going through some of their dribble handoff possessions earlier today. The Bucks still aren't bringing Brook Lopez up very highly. So I think that leaves Miami open to some Bam Adebayo, Duncan Robinson dribble handoffs or any kind of screen action there. They're going to have built-in looks. And that was the problem last year. You can't give Miami automatics with the kind of movement shooters that they have. So I'm curious to see if Bud adjusts because there have been some hints of Brook playing a little bit higher this year. It's kind of waxed and waned, at least over the last couple of weeks. It seems like Milwaukee's kind of gone back to their base more than anything. Still switching more than last year, but a little bit less than they were switching earlier this season, which is a little bit confusing. But I'm curious to see. I mean, this is money time for Bud. If I want to throw out an X factor early, it's going to be Bud. because as much as I praised Milwaukee for switching things up this year, figuratively and literally, this is the time for those changes to take place. We are in money time now. So hopefully the reps that Milwaukee got during the regular season, doing more switching, showing a little bit higher in pick and roll, doing things differently offensively, this is the time to stick to those guns. Because I think ultimately you're going to have to switch against Miami because you don't want Miami to get you in rotation. So if Milwaukee proves that they are still willing to do that, this is their series to take, because I do think they are a better team. They're going to have, they should have the best player on the floor in Giannis. They have more counters offensively, which is also kind of a problem over the last couple seasons. So this should be the series for Milwaukee to take. They just have to basically keep doing what they've been building towards this season.
That's very interesting. Now, the one thing you said as far as Miami, probably would really love to be in that 4-5 matchup, but I think of the top three teams, Philly, Brooklyn, and Milwaukee, this is probably the one you wanted to face. Now, their path is going to be extremely difficult. In theory, to make it to the finals, you have to beat all three of them, mm-hmm. which is going to be tough. The question I have is, does Miami have to change anything game plan-wise? Yes, Drew is better. Drew is there, but do they have to change anything?
I think they do on the margins. Like, you can't drop – I mean, you can't duck under picks against Drew the way that you could with Eric Bledsoe. You still can dare him to shoot, but, like, that's more of a losing proposition. Like, Miami just didn't care if Eric Bledsoe shot. Ducking under Drew Holiday means – he's fine at this, but he's better at the driving. So this is a lesser of two evils. And I think there is a slight difference there. So I wonder about how they're going to play Drew, because not only can he get busier in pick and roll and make better decisions and quicker decisions if he gets downhill, he also gives you the post-up threat. So it's not even like you could just stash a smaller guy on him and divert your attention elsewhere to Giannis or Chris Middleton or whatever. And not to take too much from the result of the Bucks Heat game over the weekend, but I guess something else to watch for is that Brook Lopez, at least in that game on, I want to say Saturday, he posting up a lot. I think he, if I remember correctly, he did not take a three in that game, which is interesting. Not being purely used as a stretch five, a guy that can mash smaller guys on the block. So if that's a wrinkle that Milwaukee is open to going to, that's going to change the way that Miami might want to send extra help to Giannis if they want to do that. Because one of my early thoughts was, Miami has the ability to say, all right, Bam, take Giannis. We're going to put Trevor Ariza in his 7'2 or 7'3 wingspan on Brook Lopez, and if they want to post him up, then fine. But if Brook Lopez is going to be that good at it and that willing to do so, then I think they might have to play things straight and just kind of use Trevor Ariza in the Jay Crowder role from last year and say, hey, just eat up these positions against Giannis. You might not stop him, but at least bother him a little bit. And with this version of Giannis, I don't know if that's going to be enough.
I mean, I still think they'll build the wall. They'll still switch. They'll still show help. They'll force the kickouts, live with what they got. Another question I have for you, because I'm letting you go off on this one. I'm clearing out on this one for you.
Okay.
How much of what Milwaukee did this year as far as making adjustments was for this series?
For this specific series? I would imagine that it weighed pretty heavily, because with them losing to Toronto a couple of years ago, well, no, I won't even make that point. I would say I think that recency obviously plays a part, and the way that Miami was able to bomb away, they got good stuff from Duncan Robinson. They really got some stuff from Jay Crowder, and I'm sure that probably didn't sit well with Milwaukee. And then just offensively, like, Miami was able to kind of steal them a little bit with the way that they were able to build that wall. In 2 years straight of a wall being built against your best player, it's going to force some changes, or at least it should. I mean, the first year should have forced a change, but whatever. 2 years in a row, you have to do something differently. So I think that does play a part into it. And even just the way that Milwaukee lost the series. Like that game one where Jimmy Butler just announces himself as the best player on the floor, where an MVP was also on the floor. Like, that also had to leave a pretty poor taste in the mouth there. So I think it definitely plays a part, but ultimately Milwaukee needed those changes anyway.
Yeah, I was just curious because as I was watching a little bit of that Bucks Heat game, I was looking and I was like, so maybe that's why they went to the dunker spot spacing. Because as Giannis had a post up, they were showing help, but the help on the backside was a small. So you're sending help to Goran Dragic instead of having one of your longer guys there, which intrigued me. Who is it more important for Miami to stop, Chris Middleton or Drew Holiday?
I think it's more important for them to stop Drew Holiday. Because I think ultimately, I think Jimmy Butler's, Miami's going to switch and trap all over the place regardless. But I think just from a matchup standpoint, like Jimmy Butler is going to get the Chris Middleton assignment, I feel like. And I think they're going to be okay with Jimmy Butler on him. And even if you're subbing a guy in, they're going to be okay with Andre Iguodala on Chris Middleton. Middleton's a better player. He should still be able to shoot over the top. But just from the archetype, just from the wingspan, just from the IQ, like Andre Iguodala is going to be in his airspace at least. Miami's guard defenders leave a lot to be desired. Let's just put it that way. So this is a series that Drew Holiday could get busy in. And if Drew gets going, then yeah, I don't know what else you do because Chris is going to knock down his mid-range jumpers or whatever, and Giannis is Giannis. If Drew is also pushing the triple for you, like there just isn't much you can do at that point.
All the adjustments that Milwaukee has made, all the improvements they've made, does any of it matter if Miami just goes zone?
That is a good question.
On a heater, folks.
On a heater, I get it. But I think it still matters. Like, I think Giannis in particular getting a little bit better in that mid-range area is going to help. He can just kind of flash middle, and he's a dribble away. He's gotten more comfortable with the mid-range jumper in general. And, I mean, it's also going to depend on where he plays it. If it's not the middle of the floor, it's maybe the wing area. Miami typically puts their smaller guys at the edge of the zone anyway, so maybe that's kind of a switch, and you kind of force some help that way, and you can kind of bend it. So I think there are ways for Milwaukee to beat it. I think mixing up the spacing, just the alignment of the offense helped. I mean, that throws in some extra looks that they've gotten used to making, some different reads they've gotten used to making, having the guy at the dunker spot. So they're getting used to those like interior dump offs. So I think that would help against the zone. So Miami could bother them in spurts. I don't think that's a solution against Milwaukee.
Solution, maybe not, but if you have what you do against Giannis, you're able to mix zone, you can throw different looks, keep him off rhythm. There's a world where that could happen, potentially. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you wanted to see Milwaukee be able to make the adjustments. And my question is, can Miami do enough to make Milwaukee feel that pressure? Can they force enough offensively to force Milwaukee to adjust?
I think they can, especially since the offense is humming now. Like, the big variable in all this, Milwaukee won the season series 2-1. They played twice in December. I think it was Milwaukee's, fourth and fifth game of the season. So the teams are wildly different from then. And then you had the matchup on Saturday. But Jimmy Butler did not play in any of those games. So, like, there's only so much to take from that to begin with. But just to answer your question about the adjustments, like, the main thing that comes to mind is the switching. It's encouraging that Milwaukee has switched more because they need to learn how to do it. It has been a bit wonky at times. And if there's a team that can kind of slice you up with slips and cuts, it would be Miami. And if they are switching, especially if they're soft switching, Jimmy Butler does not mind mismatch hunting. Bam Adebayo very quietly has gotten a little bit better at mashing smaller dudes on the block. So that could be something. And depending on the lineup Milwaukee has out there, like they do love them some Bryn Forbes off the bench, Miami might have some guys to hunt. So there's absolutely a pathway to where Miami rolls offensively to the point to where Milwaukee has to do some different things.
Interesting, because I feel like that would be kind of a victory for Miami. If mm-hmm. they can make Milwaukee adjust and now they're searching, it's kind of a good thing for the Heat. One thing that intrigued me, PJ Tucker was guarding Tyler Hero last time they played, which was yesterday. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I don't love that. It was just weird to see. I think it was less, it was more weird because like there were some pick and roll possessions with Tyler Hero, with PJ Tucker defending him, and PJ Tucker's like fighting over the screen. I'm just like, why do you have PJ Tucker in the game if you're not just going to switch things with him, especially if you're going to put him on a guard? Because I would imagine the reason you have him on a guard is so you can just kind of switch and take away those openings. So that was just kind of weird for me to see.
All pressure. PJ Tucker guarding Tyler Hero said a lot to me. It tells me Milwaukee is saying, you're not going to do it. You specifically. We're going to put PJ Tucker on you. You're going to have to deal with that, my guy.
I feel that.
And you're going to have to figure that out, Tyler Hero. But we're not going to let you be a part of it. And for Miami to get this done, they need Dragic, Hero, and Duncan humming and able to stay on the floor. Mm-hmm. Playing on both ends. So when you have Jrue Holiday who can mismatch Hunt, you have Chris Middleton who can mismatch Hunt. And that was partially the big thing I thought was missing from Milwaukee's attack last year. They decided not to do that until it was too late. And now you have a guy like PJ Tucker off the bench who could potentially bother one or both of them with the pressure and the activity. It intrigued me. I was like, huh, that's interesting. But yeah. Those are my questions. Who's your X factor for you?
X factor for me on Miami side, I think it's going to be Goran Dragic, especially if we get to the point to where Milwaukee is just going to drop Lopez and Bobby Portis. They're going to need Dragic to get downhill and make some plays in the intermediate area. Like he's going to have the floater going. He's going to have that elbow jumper going. He's going to have the lob chemistry on deck with Bam Adebayo. Because if he's not bringing it offensively, he's going to get hunted on the defensive end. He's going to have a time defending Jrue Holiday if that's what it comes down to. With Milwaukee mismatch hunting a little bit more, if they try to stash him somewhere, they will find him. So they're going to need him to give them a solid like 15 and 6 solid shooting splits. Doesn't have to be those specific numbers, but he has to bring that impact as a pick and roll ball handler. Because he's also a guy that's going to help take some pressure off of Jimmy Butler. Because you know what the defense against Butler is going to be. Like, you know they're going to switch, or if they are going to stay, or if they are going to try to defend it with two, you know they're going to duck under and dare him to shoot. So, like, Goran Dragic is the guy, the established guy anyway, that you have to kind of go over screens on. And he can kind of make plays for you that way. So I think so much of Miami's season, I mean, particularly making the Victor Oladipo trade, is trying to make sure that Dragic was healthy for the stretch run and making sure that they could rev things up with him later in the season so he could piece things together offensively. So if that's all for naught, then we don't have much to talk about. Who would your X factor be for the series?
I'm going super obvious, but to me, I think they're the most important guys. From Milwaukee, has to be Chris Middleton. Has to be Jrue Holiday. They're going as far as those two guys take them. Mm-hmm. Giannis is great, don't get me wrong. But if those guys aren't right, aren't scoring, aren't those kind of factors, aren't humming, it gets a little trickier for Milwaukee. And then for Miami, it's got to be Dragic, Hero, and Robinson. They have to show up. They have to make shots. They have to be able to defend. They have to be able to be on the floor. It just opens up the lineups for them. So those guys have to play well. So that's what I got. So you got Bucks in 4 or 5?
Jesus, I don't have them on 4 or 5. I have Milwaukee in 6. Tightly contested series, but I ultimately think Milwaukee's the better team. I think the adjustments that they've made are going to make them more equipped to deal with postseason basketball. I just think there are too many holes that can be poked in Miami to feel comfortable picking them in the series. Would not be surprised at all if they pulled it off, but I think Milwaukee has the juice this year.
I mean, you picked them to go to the finals, so I'd hope you'd say that.
Yeah, this is true. They are still my finals pick. Who would you take?
I think Heat and 6.
Heat and 6. Okay, I'll bounce one off of you then. If Miami does win this series and Milwaukee goes home in the first round, how trying to figure out the correct way to phrase this. I just want to know, like, who's going to be on the roster next year for Milwaukee if they lose in the first round after all of this?
Everyone. No, I mean, here's the thing about this series. Miami doesn't have a very large margin for error. Mm-hmm. So A, B, C, and D have to happen for them to pull this off. Milwaukee has made the improvements to where they should go ahead and take this. And I'm sure they're going to be locked in on both ends. Just mm-hmm. even in the way they played that game with Jimmy out yesterday, they seemed very focused and intent and wanted to win that game. The only question mark becomes if Miami can lower that confidence level, if they can make it a dogfight. And that's where the game plan defense for me makes it interesting. The different looks they can throw at them. The zone. Keep them out of rhythm. Can you get Milwaukee into a mode where they're starting to think? And now they're having to make those adjustments and they're trying to figure out which one's going to work. And that's where I may think it swings. So I wouldn't be surprised the Bucks advance, but I think it's hard for me as a defensive guy to go against Miami's defense. So I'm going to trust Miami's defense right now.
Okay, fair enough. Like I certainly would not have an issue with Miami pulling this series out, but I do think Milwaukee's better. I feel I have fewer questions in this particular matchup for Milwaukee than I do with Miami. And with that, I think we are good. I think all the games have closed out at this point. But we will preview the rest of these playoff series on a midweek episode. Steve, do you have anything else?
Midweek what?
It's a fantastic bit. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Dunker Spot. You can find us on Apple, on Spotify, on Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Nikias NBA. You can find Steve Jones Jr. at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later on this week with even more playoff preview content.
Bye.